You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at wslr.org.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barasonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
During the COVID-19 lockdowns, a remarkable change happened when human activity was severely curtailed. The air and water cleared, animals roamed city streets, worldwide carbon emissions plunged. The non-human world flourished, if only briefly. Scientists studying the phenomena called it anthropause. Our endless growth economic system is coming up against some very hard physical limits. Water becomes unusable when chemical and plastic pollution levels rise. Deforestation and ocean acidification is accelerating climate chaos as CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere. The world around us has a limited amount of raw materials. Green technology promises a way out of the predicament, but that's a mirage. Building electric cars and solar panels causes destruction from mining and waste product. It's also limited by the amount of available resources and the energy needed to implement the switch. No technological fix will be enough. We need to change the assumptions behind the technology. We are the hungry ghosts of Buddhist lore who consume and consume but can never be filled. A constellation of illnesses defined as diseases of despair, drug use, alcohol abuse, suicide, are rising in the United States. With all the material abundance, we aren't having a good time. It's time to take stock of what makes life worth living and act accordingly. An economy geared towards sufficiency, not profit, would be a good start. Instead of focusing on energy efficiency, we need to focus on absolute reductions in energy and material use. And that means everybody. Excess consumption in high-income populations needs to be redirected toward meeting basic needs. Shorter work hours, higher pay, and more time for leisure, community building, and civic engagement would solve a host of ills. It's not just the climate that's increasingly chaotic. Our political systems are fracturing under the pressure of income inequality. As the wealthy tighten their grip on the levers of power, the entire system wobbles towards catastrophe. Our fate is linked to that of the underlying ecological infrastructure. When the biological processes filtering the air and water and producing food collapse, so will human populations and the civilization that supports it. The COVID lockdowns taught us how the non-human world can quickly bounce back if it's given space to thrive. In his book, Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth, Stan Cox makes the case that by voluntarily reducing our consumption, we can not only save the living ecosystems, we can make a better life for ourselves. Stan, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
What's meant by the term degrowth? Is this a decline?
The term degrowth is often misinterpreted, and the people in academia who study degrowth and the larger movement pushing for degrowth like to say that the term is intentionally provocative, and it certainly doesn't mean that what we want to do is just drive gross domestic product, drive the amount of wealth being generated down year by year. The goal rather is to reduce the quantities of energy and material resources and the destruction of ecosystems and our contribution to extinction of species, et cetera, to drive society's impact on the earth down year by year, to degrow our footprint, you might say.
Wouldn't this be reverting to, I don't know, even a pre-industrial way of life?
We would still be able to use the mechanisms that we have to meet all the basic necessities of life, you know, housing, food, clothing, etc., and to sustain quite a good life. But by using such fewer resources, we would have to direct them all toward meeting basic needs and sustaining the collective quality of life. And there would not be profligate use of fuels and minerals and other inputs to simply to make a lot of unnecessary stuff or perform a lot of unnecessary services that are done now purely to earn profits.
How is degrowth different from green growth?
The idea of green growth, or over the past year, it's been called abundance also. The idea is that we can continue increasing the amount of human economic activity, continue doing everything we're doing now, making what we're making now, but even more of it, simply through developing new technology, innovation, etc. And this idea that growth of any system can go on indefinitely without stopping has been something that for at least a century has been central to our economic model, but it's just impossible. There are finite quantities of resources. Nothing in the rest of the biological world grows infinitely.
Cancer cells do.
You know, they eventually kill their host.
Well, isn't that where we're heading?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Back in the 70s, the economist Kenneth Boulding, who was one of the few who realized that their economic formulas don't work in the real world, he said, well, anybody who believes that growth can go on forever is either a fool or an economist. And it has continued to be at the root of economies, this idea. And it's the main reason, for example, we've made absolutely no progress on stopping climate change, because everything we need to do for that is going to affect economic growth rate. And so it gets vetoed by people in corporate boardrooms in Washington.
I think a lot of us have come to the conclusion that we really need to change the mindset completely on how we're running our economy. But given the current political climate, which is openly hostile to even acknowledging the severity of the climate crisis, is degrowth feasible?
Well, certainly the odds are stacked against us. If things go on with business as usual, we'll continue heading down the road toward civilizational collapse. And it's going to mean doing the equivalent of turning a huge semi that's going down the interstate at 80 miles an hour, doing an immediate U-turn. So it's not going to be easy. But that's one reason I wrote the book. Instead of people getting caught on that, well, how is that even possible? I said, okay, I'll just do a thought experiment and assume, what if we did manage to do this and have a society that serves people and not profit, etc.?
Wouldn't degrowth mean we would have less stuff? And doesn't more stuff make us happy?
Yes, that is the other theme of this book, is that producing and having more stuff is behind many of the ills and dangers and nuisances and annoyances of society today. And so in the book, I said, okay, let's imagine that we have gotten control over producing overabundance of everything. What are the things that we will, I mean, there may be some things we like that we leave behind, but let's talk about all of these awful things that make our society so stressed and often miserable, which of those are we going to leave behind forever? And, or maybe our children or grandchildren will, and we'll be happy to see them gone forever.
Okay, so two of the things that you talk about us leaving behind would be advertising and planned obsolescence. When I think about advertising, I think about that as being the engine of misery because it inflicts this idea on us that purchasing more stuff is going to make up for personal inadequacies. Why does this economic model not have advertising?
The purpose of advertising is to convince people to buy things that they have no desire to have them. They may not have even thought of it, but an inventor said, okay, we could make this gadget and it would be a shiny new thing and people will buy it and it'll make us a lot of money. If you stop making that kind of stuff and are producing things that people need, tomatoes or...
Yeah, when they first started genetically engineering tomatoes, people looked at these very easy to transport, very tasteless fruits. People who were selling them said, well, we don't need people to actually eat them. We just need them to buy them.
Yeah, that's how it works. And surveys and polls show that people absolutely loathe advertising and people pay a lot of money to subscribe to programs that don't have advertising. And if advertising was terrible 15 or 20 years ago, it's three times as terrible now because it's so intrusive that they're not only showing you a lot of annoying stuff, but they're gathering data on you. So really, it's come to the point where nobody likes ads.
The other part of that question was planned obsolescence. What is planned obsolescence and why would doing away with it be a good thing?
The term was, I think, originally come up with in the 1950s by a guy named Vance Packard, who wrote a book about public relations and advertising called The Hidden Persuaders. And one of the ways of increasing sales was to produce products that are going to go out of date for one reason or another quite soon or simply wear out. At that time, one of the big ones was changing the design of automobile models every year, making them drastically different year to year. And everybody would want to have the new design. Today, I guess, so-called fast fashion is one of those where their clothes that can maybe only worn a few times and thrown away. One of the most annoying things, and especially with digital goods and so forth, is products that can't be repaired. Or if they can be repaired, you have to take it to someone who has a computer that analyzes the like cars these days. You can't do it without that.
It needs a specialist. And the idea that we would buy a new iPhone every year and buy a new car every year makes the economy grow, but at the same time, drowning in the waste products. I know the fast fashion has been a tremendous disaster with adding microplastics to everything. But it would take a really big change in mindset for people to say, you know what, we need to stop producing throwaway stuff and we need to produce things that might cost more, but they last a really long time. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're talking about, isn't it? Having things that you could have and didn't throw away, maybe even in a whole lifetime.
During World War II, when there were shortages of resources, the government put out mandatory guidelines for producing clothing that was highly durable, not fancy, and people did fine with that. And there was rationing of shoes, for example, so that there would be enough shoes to go around, but not be putting so many resources into manufacturing.
Sarasota County reminds residents that lithium-ion batteries must be disposed of safely to prevent trash fires, one of the fastest-growing hazards in the solid waste industry nationwide. Even small batteries, like those in earbuds, can ignite under compaction. These fires threaten the safety of residents, drivers, collectors, first responders, and nearby structures. Lithium-ion batteries should not be placed in curbside trash or recycling carts. They can be disposed of at Sarasota County Household Hazardous Waste Facilities or participating retailers. Lithium-ion batteries are found in many items, including power banks, vape devices, wireless mice and keyboards, electric toothbrushes, LED flashlights, toys, and more. More information is available at scgov.net/solid waste. This is the Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Stan Cox, and we're talking about his book, Anthropause. There's a whole industry devoted to decluttering because people feel overwhelmed by the amount of things that keep accumulating around them. But there would be howls of protest if there were government regulations around what clothes should look like and what they should be made out of. This is the problem that I have with degrowth, is that it would take a huge propaganda campaign to make people actually understand how important this is. And nobody's doing that.
That's why I couldn't start at the end of the process and have somebody policing product after product and saying we can have this and not have that. It would need to come upstream at the very beginning of where the destruction happens. And what I and other people have been proposing is a hard cap on the production or import of fossil fuels and have that cap ratcheted down year by year. So fewer tons of coal, cubic feet of gas, or barrels of oil are burned every year. And that, of course, would mean that there would have to be some allocation of fuels and materials also to industries that are producing what's needed. And if you had that, for one thing, you wouldn't need declutterers anymore, because without the resources going to produce superfluous or unnecessary or even harmful products, people's houses wouldn't be filling up. Lots of studies show that materialism or pursuit of material goods or ownership of more and more stuff has bad psychological effects, whereas not having that burden of possessions tends to lead people to seek out more social interaction and be happier.
One of the aspects of everyday life that would have to be completely rehauled would be our transportation system, because we're so, at least in the United States, so dependent, and the United States is responsible for a lot of the ecological destruction. We'd have to do something about our transportation system. What would a degrowth transportation system look like? And what would be the benefits?
I've got a chapter on that in the book. For one thing, we would be able to walk around our own cities or towns or suburbs or rural areas without risk of suddenly being killed. Pedestrian deaths being hit by vehicles have soared in the past 10, 15 years, increased 70%. The number of people who've been killed by large pickup trucks and SUVs increased 140% because they're taller and heavier and kill a pedestrian more often than smaller cars.
They're harder to stop. And when they hit somebody, they do a lot of damage.
Right. And then to accommodate these things, we've built our whole environment to accommodate these vehicles more than people, including 30% of urban land now that's not under buildings. 30% of the land is under concrete and asphalt. And there are all these requirements to have businesses have to have so many parking spaces for the size of the business. So parts of our city or town are pretty much 100% covered by concrete, and that creates social crater and causes people who can afford to move further and further out into the suburbs.
What do you mean by a social crater?
A huge parking lot that is not meant for people to be in at all. It's just a place to store vehicles that aren't being used, leaves no room for any kind of social activity. What they call concrete jungles that build up in rings around cities kill off social interaction in those areas, and people move further and further out, and then they suffer the misery of commuting and traffic jam.
One of the things that surprised me was the damage caused by electric vehicles. Part of it is they wear out tires really quickly, and that produces a new kind of pollution.
That's one of the more recently learned things about electric vehicles. Maybe not the biggest one, but David Zipper, who writes a lot about the problems of automobiles, wrote an article about this last year, I think, that to charge the big battery a little bit as you're going along, the electric vehicles put the brakes on just slightly at certain times, and that helps charge the battery. They're doing that in pulses, and that is causing the tires to wear more, and the tread wears down. That rubber goes somewhere, tiny particulate matter that all vehicles produce. It causes a lot of ecological problems, but tire dealers are reporting that people are coming back with tires and they say, oh, this is a 40,000 mile tire and I've only gone 13,000 miles and Fred's already gone. But the much bigger environmental impact of the motor vehicles is the huge batteries that they use. And the larger and heavier the vehicle, the bigger the battery. The electric F-150 pickup truck, for example, has a battery that's the size of two mattresses and weighs a ton. The electric Hummer's battery weighs as much as an entire gas-powered Honda Civic. So it's like it's carrying a whole car.
And why would anybody need that? That's an absurd vehicle.
People think, well, it's more ecologically sound. It's not burning fossil fuel, but the manufacturer of that battery in that vehicle uses a lot of energy, generates a lot of emissions, and the metals, lithium, cobalt, rare earths, other metals that go into those batteries are increasingly the subject of conflict around the world.
Another part of the economy that would have to be completely reconfigured would be food production, because our current system of food production relies heavily on fossil fuels. So if we were to power down, what would be the advantages of changing our food production system?
A large quantity of field corn that is going to feed automobiles in producing ethanol is an additive to fuel. And that is totally an industry that exists to support corn farmers, because ethanol, it's not as efficient a fuel. It isn't necessary for running cars. And there are millions of acres of land in this country where the soil's being degraded to produce corn, to produce ethanol, to burn in a car. And so you're taking the carbon from the plants, putting it in a car, and the car sends the carbon back into the atmosphere.
So maybe we could rip up all those huge parking lots and have that be grazing land for the animals instead of having them force-fed. And then if we had more local food production, that would also cut down on the amount of fossil fuels we need, because I remember going to the grocery store here in Oregon and seeing lamb from New Zealand. And sheep grow very well in Oregon because of the climate, but the supermarket had lamb from all the way from New Zealand.
Urban agriculture is great for things like fruits and vegetables, fresh produce, because, as you know, produce that comes from a couple of thousand miles away is often not fit to eat. And plus, there is a lot of environmental damage done that way. Grains and beans, dry beans and that kind of food, though, takes up a lot more acreage and will always need to be grown out in places like Kansas, where I used to live. But that's okay, because it's very compact, dry, non-perishable food, and it can be taken by rail cars to wherever it needs to go.
One of the scenarios you looked at in the book was powering down the lights in our cities. Wouldn't that make the cities more dangerous if they weren't as brightly lit?
There's been research on this, and it showed where they dimmed the lighting in areas of cities and various socioeconomic levels and various ethnic groups and so forth. And none of those situations did dimming the light result in an increase in crime. And in fact, lighting has been used as a kind of racial profiling segregation way to say there are businesses that have a lot of outdoor light, or commercial and industrial areas. Those, as you know, are often sited in areas where you have low income or racialized communities, and upper class people can afford houses back where you have nice nighttime darkness, but it's not associated with the amount of crime. The amount of light wherever you are is not associated with the amount of crime.
But it would be nice to see the night sky again.
Yes, we all have probably noticed how, compared with even 20 years ago, how few stars we see, even on a very clear night. That's because of overlighting, but the overlighting was greatly exacerbated starting in around 2011, when street lights and other parking lot lights, stadiums, etc., switched to LED lighting, which they did because it's more energy efficient. But instead of conserving energy, companies and municipalities instead said, okay, we can really crank up the light now and we won't have to spend any more on electricity. So they, and you've probably noticed this, that billboards and so forth can really be blinding. Between 2012 and 2022, in 10 years, the sky glow, that bleaching out of the sky that obscures the stars, makes it so that you can't see stars. Sky glow has been increasing 10% per year in cities and towns.
That's a lot.
Over the past, right. Yeah, it's reduced the number of stars you can see by more than half, and it's getting worse every year. And you may say, well, the night sky, astronomers, aesthetes, and so forth, that may bother them, but is it really a problem? But you think about how the stars and planets, Milky Way, Andromeda, throughout human history, how important that has been culturally, scientifically, just for people's mental well-being. Losing that is a terrible tragedy. It's something that's free. Everybody has access to it whenever they want, except if it gets bleached out. That's one thing that degrowth put a dimmer switch on immediately, and we would have the night sky back.
I was really struck by how much better, and what we've been talking about is just a few of the examples, but how much better life could be all the way around, because the idea is we stop producing for profit and we start producing for what's going to make human life more agreeable. What a concept. What a concept.
In the process, it won't be that we are regretfully leaving behind. There's some things we may miss, but there's a lot of bad stuff that overproduction causes, and we can be free of that.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Stan Cox, and we've been talking about his book, Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. Stan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marianne.